Abbreviated version of alternative views. We have with us two people to discuss the upcoming bond election and some of the alternatives or the non-alternatives presented to us by the City Council. With us is Betty Ann Duke of the House Study Group. Welcome, Betty, who has been the who's the author of an article in the Texas Observer, Lignite Stripping Away the Illusions. And also with us is David Weir of the Texas Mobilization for Survival, author of a position paper. They're here to discuss Lignite. David, I think I'm an attentive citizen, but I'm really confused by the upcoming bond election on April 7th. Would you discuss the alternatives briefly?
Well, I'd be glad to, Jack. It's not hard to be confused on this ballot because there are four confusing propositions. I'll go over them real quickly. The first proposition on this ballot will request Austin voters to fund the full 16% share in the South Texas nuclear plant, requiring an additional outlay of over $200 million more dollars to the nuke plant. The second proposition on the ballot will authorize the city of Austin to sell our complete share in this nuke plant. Now, the third proposition on the ballot will request $433.8 million worth of bonds to go towards the building of a new lignite or coal plant in Fayette County. The fourth proposition on the ballot will permit the transfer of funds from the potential sale of the nuke plant to be directed towards the construction of a coal or lignite fired electric generating facility in Fayette County.
So it's possible that you could be against nuclear power and still walk into lignite might enter through the back door.
That's very possible. The city council and many of the groups around town who are taking an active role in this election have not brought out many of the dangerous side effects and potential that lignite development and this lignite plant will propose for the city of Austin and its environmental habitat around this area.
Well, you're jumping the gun on us. First of all, I'm still confused about what is lignite. Maybe you can help us out on that, Betty Ann.
Well, lignite is a soft brown coal. Used to be called brown dirt. It has a very low heat content. It's very dirty to burn because it has a lot of ash and sulfur in it. But Texas has a lot of it, more than any other state. And the development is going to be very big in the state. What that means is a whole lot of strip mining and a whole lot of coal-burning power plants. There are about 1 million acres of land in Texas that have lignite. And the belt goes from up around Texarkana, through East Texas, the Piney Woods, through the underneath the National Forest, down through Central Texas, the grasslands, the really rich farmland. In fact, about 85 to 90% of the lignite is found underneath prime farmland. It extends on down through the Lost Pines area in Bastrop, on down through the grasslands in South Texas all the way to Laredo. So it's a lot of land that we're talking about. And, well, to give you an example of how rapid the development's going to be, about 3 years ago there were 2 million tons of lignite burned in the state, and by 1985 predictions are that around 75 million tons will be burned. And right now, the utility companies are the main people who are both mining and burning lignite. The way it works is that there's usually a lignite mine and right next to it a power plant, because lignite is both dangerous and expensive to transport. And so most of the mines in the state now are owned and run by utility companies. And plans are for there to be 14 of these mine mouth power plants in the state by 1985 for utility companies alone. Texas Utilities Company up in northeast Texas is the biggest miner in the state. And the industrial development is harder to predict. You may have heard the vice president of Texas A&M say not long ago that there so much industry is going to be drawn to Texas Lignite Belt that it will look like the Ruhr Valley, which is the biggest industrial area in the world.
As a matter of fact, I think there's a gentleman, Robert Cargill, an oil and gas entrepreneur, that says in this business publication, Texas Business, that it is his conviction that the greatest area of industrial development in the United States during the last quarter of this century will be within 100 miles of right where we're sitting. The sitting he's talking about is Dallas, Texas, which 126 miles east of Dallas is Longview, Texas.
Yes, I've heard such predictions. And we don't. There's not a whole lot of industrial development that's going on right now, although Shell Oil has recently had a permit approved. Now, Alcoa Aluminum has been mining it for several years. But we do know that a lot of the major oil companies and major chemical companies have bought up lignite leases. Dow Chemical, Phillips, Exxon, Union Carbide, one right after the other, are the main people who do control the lignite in the state.
We've heard those companies before, Frank, haven't we? We've talked about them on Alternative Views. You know, David, we've talked a lot about the health hazards associated with nuclear power, but it's just very recently it's come to my attention that there's some very serious, even perhaps even more dramatic examples of potential health hazards associated with lignite. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Well, certainly there are very serious health consequences from the burning of coal or lignite in Texas for our atmosphere. And when you multiply this by 49, which is the number of proposed coal and lignite plants online by 1986 in Texas, you've got some pretty severe pollution that's going to be coming down, in great quantities of it, too. Hundreds of thousands of tons, millions of tons of sulfur dioxides and nitrogen oxides. And there's a simple statement: what goes up must come down. This stuff is going to come down. It's going to come down on our crops. It's going to come down on our buildings. It's going to come down on us. Sulfur dioxide's probably one of the most dangerous of air pollutants that's released into the atmosphere. The Texas Energy Outlook estimates that if all proposed coal and lignite mines go into operation by 1985, Texas will see a 55% increase in sulfur oxides in our atmosphere, and that is with the installation of scrubbers on the plants. Presently, only one Texas utilities plant right now has a scrubber.
Scrubbers are not mandated as it is now.
No, they are not. And as a matter of fact, recently, Department of Energy Secretary James Schlesinger has proposed emergency suspension of the Clean Air Act, and you can imagine what that would do to the sulfur oxides level in our atmosphere.
They're using this whole Iran and this artificial crisis that we've talked about here on Alternative Views as a means, as a leverage to force people and to scare people into believing that we have to give up on clean air and clean environment, are they not?
That's right.
What does the sulfur dioxide do to you? What are the consequences of being in the air and around?
Well, essentially, for individuals, it will cause a lot of respiratory problems, particularly for members of the population who are elderly and who have various health problems with their breathing, emphysema and stuff like that. As far as what it will do to the land, when sulfur dioxide combines with moisture in the atmosphere, it will create sulfuric acid. And sulfuric acid, when it rains down out of the atmosphere, is going to corrode buildings. That's already been proven. It's happening in Rome right now. It will also, when it rains down on lakes, it will disrupt the pH balance in the lakes, and it will make the lakes virtually devoid of fish.
By pH, you mean the acid level?
The acid level in the lakes will be dramatically increased. It'll be an imbalance.
I think you have an illustration where they've had mining of this sort in West Virginia. Tell a story.
Well, that's true. In West Virginia, where they've had coal development for a long time, they've burned quite a bit of it, 10,000 miles of their streams are now considered biologically sterile.
Which means dead.
Dead, right. There's no fish life, no aquatic life in them. In the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York, which is up from all the industrial development in New York City, many of the lakes up there are virtually devoid of fish because of the acid rain raining down on the lakes. Nitrogen oxides is another very serious pollutant that comes from these lignite and coal plants. And Dr. Samuel Weinstein of Case Western Reserve University has determined that previous levels of safe standards for nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere are not sufficient. Lower levels of nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere do induce cancer, as was not previously thought. And in Texas, there'll be lots of nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere from the burning of lignite. Another problem that is that has not been publicized at all by these forces that are trying to promote this industrialization of Texas is the disbursement of radiation in the atmosphere from the burning of lignite.
We've heard a lot about that in terms of nuclear power. We haven't heard much of it in terms of lignite.
Right. That's because they're either trying to keep it quiet or I don't know what their intentions could be for this. It would certainly put a crimp in their industrial development plans were it to get a lot of publicity. But Hal Cooper, who is a scientist at the University of Texas, has estimated that a lignite plant will release up to 4 times the amount of radiation into the atmosphere that a nuclear plant will in its day-to-day operations. Now, I'm not talking about radioactive waste. I'm just talking about daily emissions of radiation. Now, Floyd Galpin, who is head of the Environmental Protection Agency's Radiation Analysis Division in Washington, D.C., wrote me a letter a couple weeks ago, and he told me that, indeed, that the effects of radiation released from a lignite plant will have more severe radiobiological effects on the population and the surrounding communities than that which is released from a nuclear plant.
Wow. Why is that? I don't understand. You say the radiation is different, or?
Apparently, the process of combustion of these radioactive particulates, which are contained within the lignite, released into the atmosphere, is the problem. And I'm not real familiar with how the radiation discharge is in a nuke plant occurs, but he tells me that a lignite plant will burn up, 114 kilograms of thorium-232, 18.5 kilograms of uranium-238, and 134.4 grams of uranium-235, which is what they make plutonium from. That's a daily disbursement of radiation from a lignite plant, a 640-megawatt lignite plant.
Whatever that was, I don't think I want it in my salad.
You certainly don't.
Is there an additional problem in the Texas area because of our high winds that occur daily, spreading this over a lot larger area than it would be if it were in another part of the country?
That's true. That's a very good point, because the stacks on these lignite plants could be as high as 300 to 400 feet high. And when they spew this stuff out into the atmosphere, it could go thousands of miles. It could not just be Texas. It could get to each of the coasts. Another point is the fact that now the industry representatives will tell you, we're going to stop most of this radiation that's coming out of these plants. We're going to put scrubbers on these plants and fuel filters, and we're going to stop it. But that's not true at all, because Texas lignites are particularly susceptible to not responding to the pollution control devices. At the only plant in Texas, utilities who have several lignite plants that has a scrubber, their Monticello plant, this plant was supposed to operate under 98% efficiency in catching particulates which release radiation. Well, the actual recovery rate of the particulates was closer to 68%, so it is releasing radiation. Now, when you magnify 49 times all these plants that are going to be releasing radiation, sulfur dioxides, nitrogen oxides, carbon dioxides, and waste heat, you've got some pretty severe pollution problems.
Well, thanks, David, for filling us in the health consequences. It seems that there must be an argument if there are these health consequences there of the economics of lignite. Is lignite the cheap fuel that the proponents are saying it is?
Well, at this time, lignite fuel is cheaper than natural gas. It might be about half the price of natural gas, but the fuel costs have escalated rapidly within the last few years. They're from 3 to 5 times as much as they were just a few years ago. And another thing to consider is that the fuel cost is only one component of the final electricity cost. And the costs of building a lignite plant are about 4 times as much as the cost of building a natural gas plant. But
That's a pretty big number. They're asking $433 million to build a lignite plant. That's a lot of money.
Right. And anyway, even if the fuel is cheaper now, regardless of whatever the real fuel costs turn out to be, lignite producers can charge as much for lignite as the market will bear. And since the same people do control the lignite market that control the natural gas market, we can expect to pay as much for lignite, if not more, than we're paying mm-hmm. right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to have cheap electricity bills because of lignite.
And if we factor in the cost of the society at large that David here has briefly outlined, those hidden social costs in terms of what we're doing to our land, the ecosphere, and ourselves,
health.
Our health, the cost of medical care, et cetera, going through the roof as it is, it's not quite the deal, the bargain that they're making it out to be, is it?
Not at all. And one other thing, too, of course, they've said that lignite development will create a lot of jobs, but it will create fewer jobs than most other big industries, and the jobs are fairly dangerous. You don't have the extent of the black lung disease that you have with underground coal mining, but still there are respiratory diseases that lignite miners are susceptible to, and there are also a lot of accidents that occur in the process of lignite mining. So it's not going to provide a lot of jobs, and they're not going to be very desirable jobs.
As a matter of fact, it's a highly capital-intensive industry,
yes.
Is it not? We have a picture here, if we can zero in on it, of camera, of just some of the machinery that they have. And to put it in perspective, we have a car here right next to the shovel. So it'll give you an idea where the capital is going. The $433 million will be going to the purchase of this, not to the creation of jobs.
That's right.
This will all be strip mining, huh?
Oh, yes.
Which they euphemistically call surface mining.
Yes, right.
Yes.
1 million acres of Texas prime farmland.
And of course, what about the reclamation? They say, oh, we'll return it back to its natural state and make a big park out of it, even a great big old lake.
Oh, that's...
We have both a state and a federal surface mining law. In Texas, the agency responsible for regulating surface mining is the Railroad Commission. And many exceptions have been granted on the regulations for the surface mining. In fact, one of the main requirements that the topsoil be segregated has consistently been set aside.
I think, David, in your position paper, you argue that they have seriously underestimated the cost of reclamation, even if they were serious about undertaking it.
Well, yeah, just think about it for a second. They spend an average of $600 to $800 to reclaim 1 acre of strip mine land. Now, I'm a landscaper, and we're a crew of 4, and we won't even come on a job for less than that money. And that we're just dealing with somebody's yard, and they're talking about an acre of land that's been dug 200 feet down with these giant power shovels, and this lignite removed, and all the soil set here and there. And they think they can do that, reclaim the land, and return it to its original condition or substantially better use for $600 or $800. It's preposterous.
Well, that's about all the time we have today for this segment. Again, in one word, if Austin is going to have a non-nuclear future, it's in your hands whether it be a lignite future. One alternative, though, that they haven't given us is the possibility of solar. In our next segment, we're going to go to Al Slavinsky with a living demonstration of a solar collector and one of the entrepreneurs in town.
We've talked in the general about alternative sources of energy, such as solar, and today we have actually a working model of a solar water heater, and with us to explain that is one of Austin's only weatherization experts.
Weatherization contractors.
Right, Mr. Claude Broder. Claude, would you explain what we have here?
Well, the unit that we have right here, okay, includes the solar collector panels with the solar hot water tank, which we recommend as a replacement unit for a an older, worn-out type of water heater, or for new homes, new construction, that will allow the system to give you back a good enough payback period. It will conserve your hot water usage, and it'll conserve the it'll give you a quicker payback period.
Right. What is the total investment on a water heater system like this right now, and what would you estimate the payback period to be?
The cost of the unit at this time is $2,000. Approximately, depending on what size, whether it's an 80-gallon system or a 100-gallon system.
We have an 80-gallon system.
This is an 80-gallon system. The cost runs just under $2,000. That includes installation. The equipment that goes with it, the expansion tanks, the hot water tanks. The system normally has a 7-year payback period.
However, that's at fixed utility rates, though, right now.
That's at current utility rates.
Which are more than likely to go up than down.
In 74, they were 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And right now, they're 6 cents per kilowatt hour. That's an increase of 300% in 4 years. You know it's going to go up again.
Right. And this is a closed or open system?
This is a closed system. We only recommend closed systems because they have they're virtually free of maintenance problems.
Right.
President Carter included a 30% tax credit on the solar system, which actually means that you'd be paying $1,400 for the system as opposed to $2,000, because the federal government will give you the improvement credits. They'll give you 30% on solar for the first $2,000 you spend on it. They'll give you an additional 20% up to $8,000. Other type of energy conservation products will give you a 15% tax credit.
Right. Do you have an example of some of the other things that people can do now to bring their energy bills down in the neighborhood of 40% to 60%, right?
Yes. In fact, I've incorporated these things into my own residence. Last August, I was paying $136 a month for my utilities. In September, after incorporating these different type of devices, my utility bill went down to $85 a month, which is still outrageous, I'm working on it.
Well, let's get on and explain some of the other forms of energy conservation that we have here, so we can get them all in.
Okay, the caulking is one of the most important things, making the house tight. Storm windows also assist in that. There are several types of storm windows on the market. This is our type that we carry. It's important to check them to make sure that they're tight. If you can push up against the window and it breaks the seal, you've got air coming through the window, and it serves no purpose. You might as well not have the window there.
Right, this is something most people wouldn't know how to check for either, would
they? Right. You need to press up, just like the wind would, press up against the thing. With the welded corners, okay, are very important. This will just make a tighter seal. Of course, you caulk all the way around the window frame when it's being in place. It's tied down with what we call a thermal break. Something to look for in these windows also is to make sure that at least double track so that you can wash the windows without having to remove them from the building. The windows will slide out. You keep that same tightness.
What about shower heads and things like that?
Well, for storm windows, now prices are quite expensive, okay? This is the average storm window that people install. They run anywhere from $22 and more. We have an alternative to that. This is a sample of it. It goes on inside of the house, and it costs you only about $4 to give you the same type of weatherization protection that this storm window does. The drawback with this is that you have to remove it whenever you want to open your windows, and you have to be able to store it somewhere.
Small inconvenience for the savings of $60 or $70 a month.
Yes, it is. This is the type I'm using on my home right now.
What are some of the other devices we have here?
Insulation is important. It's always important to have a sufficient amount of insulation. We recommend a minimum of R26 in the Centex area. For attics, we prefer the cellulose because this is our cellulose that we get. We blow it into the attic. We recommend the same thing for cavity fill, for walls, only under a wet application. That not only vermin-proofs your house, it also soundproofs it. Other types of insulation products available are of this type. It's a fiberglass. This is what we use to insulate hot water heaters, the conventional hot water heaters. There are kits on the market today for about $20, which will give you one wrap for your existing hot water heater. This item will save you about $3 a month on your gas heating bill or your electric heating bill for your hot water. If you want to save a little bit more, you can turn down the thermostat on your hot water heater. Normally, they're set at 160. That's great for a scalding shower, but who takes scalding showers? 120 is more realistic. When you do this, incorporate low-volume aerating shower heads. The average shower head in the home today uses 8 gallons per minute. A shower head of this type only uses 2.5 gallons a minute. This means you use less hot water and you require less energy to heat that water. So you're saving on your water bill and your fuel bill. Faucet aerators for the faucets also reduce the water consumption rate to 2.5 gallons per minute.
Things like solar film, we see so many ads on the TV now about solar film. Is that very effective?
Solar film, okay, depending on what brand. This solar film I've incorporated in my house, it rejects 85% of solar radiated heat. On glass sliding doors, you can't imagine how much before we put the film on, you could put your hand up there and you could really feel that heat coming through. But with the solar film applied, just that coolness and that air conditioning, that wasn't used to be heating up my garden. It was cooling my house finally. Something important, you know, a lot of people think that energy conservation is only for the people who can afford who are making a lot of money. Well, the government has a grant program for families drawing low incomes. We have information on this. Also for schools and institutions, we can provide that type of information on energy tax credits, on solar, wind, and geothermal equipment, as well as conventional conservation techniques.
Thank you a lot for being Alternative Views, Claude.
Okay, thank you very much for allowing us to be here.
Nuclear organizations throughout the world as the International Days of Protest. On June 2nd through 4th, demonstrations will be held at corporate, military, and nuclear facilities in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Japan. These actions are intended as a display of solidarity among people all over the planet in their opposition to the spread of nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. We invite members of the government, the news media, and the public to join us on Saturday, June 2nd at the South Texas Nuclear Project as we gather to express our desire for a radiation-free future. I'd like to introduce Todd Thanason with some additional information.
I got information last night, by the way, from Europe there's going to be demonstrations in Finland, Belgium, Luxembourg, Spain, Italy, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, France, Canada, Australia, Japan, England, the Netherlands, and in the U.S. Also in the same mailing I got, there's going to be demonstrations in Washington State, Oregon, California, Montana, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, Washington, D.C., South Carolina, Florida, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Maine. That was just a partial list. You haven't received the rest of them yet. The anti-nuclear movement is growing in both its size and its credibility. Within the government, a few ears are listening to us and a few voices are starting to speak. The Stop STNP demonstration and the International Days of Protest are acts of mobilization and solidarity. We intend to stop nuclear power.
Attached, and I'm watching that price tag climb. Tonight, tonight, your eyes glow bright. You must have gotten just a little too close, and your skin's all red from radiation. You must have taken an overdose. They ship out nuclear waste. It rolls in trucks across the interstate. And now some folks just give up living, and they start dying little by little, piece by piece. Some folks get off their butts and stand up and go marching in the street. Tonight, tonight, I'm filled with fright, and I'm starting to feel the heat. 'Cause it's still being built and there's not much time. Let's go marching in the street. Well, they sold us this reactor 5 years ago, and they lied about how much we would pay. But those bureaucrats, they can't bullshit me. They're gonna poison Matagorda Bay. Now they sit on their butts down in Houston, and they count their money ledger sheet. But it's not built yet, and there's still some time. Let's go marching in the street. H.L.M.P. We're calling all over Soap Creek. Let's shut down S.T.N.P.
That's not Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in the background. That's not Three Mile Island. That's the South Texas Nuclear Project in Matagorda County. Alternative Views brings its camera to Matagorda to cover the anti-nuclear demonstration here. And we're standing here in the mud, along with a lot of other people, and we're going to be wading through the crowd trying to get some interviews. Somebody asked a question. I thought the issue was settled in the recent referendum vote where the South Texas Nuclear Project participation was continued by the voters of Austin. What are you still down here arguing about anyway?
They said no one would be hurt.
I think that public momentum has to be brought to a point where the people are aware of the problem here. As it is, maybe 5 years ago, the people didn't know the problem existed, but more and more it's come out into the open, and so I think that there's a need for another referendum as the public support grows.
What are you, some of the criticisms of the nuclear power movement, anti-nuclear power movement, is that it's not conscious enough of workers' needs. Workers' jobs are being threatened if nuclear power plants are shut down. What do you propose to do about their jobs?
If you take into account the long-term costs and the nuclear waste, if it's left here in Texas someplace, then that's a cost they have to take into account as well. And just the jobs that it creates, that's only one small part of the cost of nuclear energy. The large part is something that will affect these people directly, but maybe not in the short term.
So what do you propose in the short term to do about the energy shortfall that we're now experiencing?
I'd like to add one thing. I can't believe there's an energy shortage in this country. I think there's a shortage of energy producers. There's an energy monopoly, and it won't be broken unless the people themselves do something about it.
Something
that other forms of energy should be gone into instead of nuclear power, because if there's only a reliance on nuclear power as a cheap source of energy without taking the cost of the external costs, then the reliance on that will shut us out of other forms of energy, such as solar energy or wind, things like this that can be gone into, and the money be sent into that and to explore that type of technology, I think.
Is solar energy a viable technology right now?
I believe it could be if enough money was put into the technology of solar energy, but as it is, they're not going to put the money into it if they have another cheap source of energy, which is nuclear energy, but it's cheap only if all the costs are not taken into account.
Well, think about this. Let me jump in here. Nuclear power was cheap in terms of most other forms of fuel about 5 years ago, but in terms of what's happened to the huge increases in building plants and the cost of fuel, it's probably a lot more expensive. And you also consider that in 30 years, all the fuel is going to be gone, and you've still got all the nuclear waste.
An issue to bring you out and stand in the mud like this. How do you feel about nuclear power?
Well, it's probably the most dangerous thing facing us right now, and it's got to be done away with. It's just got to be stopped.
Are you a resident of Austin?
Yes, I am.
I thought the issue was decided a couple of months ago.
Well, it wasn't decided by people like me, because I went out and voted against it, and a lot of us voted against it, and we're still against it, and I think that a lack of organization prevented it from being stopped then.
I just saw a car of a worker of the South Texas Nuclear Project, and he had a sign in the front window that said, "The SDNP feeds my family." What's your reaction to that?
I don't really have one. I'm sure it does feed his family. It's his job, and I can understand that and sympathize with it. But it's killing my family. If it's finished, it will kill my family, it will kill his family, it'll kill everyone.
Never have the young done so much for their bewildered and their treacherous elders than what you've been doing all along. Mayas and the Aztecs' human sacrifices were not unknown. and in the dawning of the Hebraic God, even Abraham, the Bible tells us, was prepared to sacrifice his own son to prove his fidelity to God. But more terrible than anything was the God of the Phoenicians and the Ammonites, the God Moloch, who demanded the most terrible sacrifice of all. Moloch demanded the sacrifice of children who died by fire. We stand here today before a modern-day Moloch. Yeah. Moloch the nuke, I call him. The priests of the nuclear cult demand that we sacrifice to this new god. But we are asking questions. What is a sacrifice? Why should we offer ourselves up, or, what's more important, our children and our children's children? For we do not want to give blind obeisance to the demands of the priests who serve this new and most terrible god.
You think about the conspicuous absence of black and brown faces in this audience.
What do I think about it?
Yes.
Oh, well, you know, the way I see it is that at the present time there is single-issue politics in America, and for struggles like this, I think it is important for us to connect the struggles. That means we got to be able to tie it up to the struggles that the Chicanos are carrying on and to the struggles that blacks are carrying on. You see, because the struggle right now is limited, and it is limited not only on the question of race, but on the question of class. That means, you know, you don't find real working class people here. I see, you know, like everybody is caught up within a political atmosphere that is unstable. That means people are tending towards single issue without tying them together. And so this is why you are seeing a kind of unique crowd here.
Do you think their absence is an expression that they see the issue of nuclear power is not relevant to their lives? The issue of jobs is more important?
Definitely. You know, there are different stages before, you know, you can set people in motion. Now, first of all, before somebody is set into motion, I got to think of food in their belly and a house over their head and a job. But, if the nuclear question is dealt with in its right setting, that means within its economic context and the way it relates to, for instance, the gains made in the 60s and the attack of the gains made in the 60s, the way it relates to the whole structure of America and, you know, the capitalist system, that other people will get interested. So it is true that the limitation put on the struggle by the people directing the struggle in limiting it to an environmental level does affect the kind of people they can turn out.
What's your opinion on this?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people who would like to be here. For example, the farm workers in Raymondville in South Texas have been struggling with an onion strike. They plan to bring a bus full of people up here today. One of their buses was firebombed a couple of weeks ago, completely destroyed. The farm workers are fighting against the same corporate interests that we're fighting here when we're fighting against the nuclear power. I think that nuclear plants are not going to be put in places like Beverly Hills. They're going to be put in places like, if this one blows, it's going to get, you know, Chicanos who are working in South Texas. I mean, there are lots of class interests in America that I think that the single issue, as this is developing now, I think the quietness of the 70s is going to change. I think people are getting much more politically sophisticated now than they were in the 60s. And I think when the 80s start heating up, things are going to be, with Watergate and everything, people are going to be much more aware of what's going on. I'm very hopeful.
You both don't look representative of the other faces I see around. It seems to be pretty much a youth-oriented group.
But we are members of Wheatsville Co-op, and we have just the same interest as the young people in seeing that things can be turned around and improved rather than going downhill like they are.
You must be pretty concerned to come out here on a day like this and stand in the mud and wade through with everybody else. What are you concerned about?
Concerned about our survival, I suppose, especially seeing with something so illogical as that they haven't even proved it's any good. Nuclear power hasn't been proved any good at all. It's no possibility of disposing of the waste, and nobody in his right mind could possibly say it was even partially safe. It's damnable. It's an atrocity. And I think somebody should do something about it, so that's the reason why we came here.
What about the workers' jobs? I just saw a worker go by in a car and with a sign saying, the STNP feeds my family. What about their jobs?
I think they're frightened, and they don't know enough about it. But when they know enough about it and have as much fear as I have, then they'll be just as much against it, especially seeing that there will be provision made for them to get jobs. It isn't as though that's going to... The energy is going to do them out of this particular job, and they're going to another job exactly the same, similar, but safe.
Is solar energy ready as a technology?
I would say not really, because not enough money's been put into it. That's the thing. You know, no one wants to get behind it. The government doesn't. The big business doesn't, you know. So right now, no. But you pour money into it, and yes, it would be.
So what do we do about the energy shortfall in the immediate?
Conserve.
We got that. We have been living in an age of plenty. Now we've got to learn to do without for a change. To be a little diplomatic about the stuff we're wasting, because when we save, our conditions are so rich that we can save an enormous lot without sacrificing hardly anything except slight discomfort.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your sign says, stop nukes, stop arms rape, stop capitalism. What has capitalism got to do with all this?
Well, I think capitalism is central to the whole struggle. Energy, and like any other commodity, is subject to all the strictures of capitalism, that it has to be produced under profitable conditions. And it seems to me that one of the basic reasons that nukes are so unsafe is precisely because they have to be produced for profit, and which means that the safety features, even if it were possible to use nuclear energy, will never be enforced and will be never guaranteed. There will always be cost cutting and all kinds of shortcuts in the production, and that it'll just be impossible to have a safe form of energy under nuclear power. You know, it's a larger problem, but in this context. It involves that nuclear power cannot be a safe form or alternative form of energy under capitalism, and therefore it has to be stopped.
I'm here with Rick Pilz, one of the spokespersons for the Mobilization for Survival. Rick, what do you think the turnout here today?
I think it's really a fantastic turnout. We have something over 800 people, possibly as many as 1,000. This is the largest anti-nuclear demonstration that we've ever had in Texas.
It's pretty remarkable given the weather and all the other obstacles that people had to come today.
At the Capitol rally that we did in January on a nice sunny Sunday afternoon in Austin, we had 500 or 600 people. And I think turning out a larger number in the mud here in Matagorda shows a real deepening of the movement.
You think it's indicative that the anti-nuclear power movement is catching on?
Oh, sure, because this demonstration here today is just one example of literally dozens, possibly hundreds of demonstrations that are going on all over the Western world today at nuclear power plants and at weapons facilities.
Weapons facilities, that's not something we hear much at this rally. What's the Mobilization for Survival's position on nuclear weapons?
Well, Mobilization for Survival has called for a nuclear moratorium, and that means a moratorium on construction of nuclear power plants and the production of any more nuclear waste, but it also means an end to the testing and production and deployment of nuclear weapons.
Rick, let me ask you, maybe this is not a fair question, but I see it seems to be a notable, conspicuous absence of black and brown faces here. There has been some who charge the anti-nuclear movement basically being middle-class radicals, countercultural hippies. What do you think about it? Why no black and brown faces here?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think that the anti-nuke movement needs to do a much better job of building bridges to a lot of different communities. We have not done the kind of coalition building with political organizations of blacks and Chicanos. We need to do a much better job of building coalitions with the churches, with labor organizations, and so forth. If we're going to win this struggle, we're going to need a much broader base than we have right now. But I think we've got an excellent beginning, and we're beginning to really have some clout.
Perhaps a dramatic expression of that was a car I just saw go by a few minutes ago, a worker apparently from the South Texas nuclear project here, who had a sign in the window saying, the STNP feeds my family. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm not for just shutting down nuclear power plants overnight with no provision for the people who earn their livings as construction workers or atomic workers. Obviously, we need some sort of conversion program. people who are working now building nuclear technology need to be given decent jobs with decent pay working on appropriate technology. Nuclear power is not a good investment for creating jobs. It's extremely capital intensive. For every $1 billion you invest in this, you create fewer jobs than in almost any other investment, except maybe nuclear weapons. Whereas if you had a program of conservation, energy conservation, solar energy development, and so forth, you could create a much larger number of jobs with the same kind of investment, jobs for all sorts of craft workers, skilled workers, so forth.
You know, Rick, in looking around, it's the whole atmosphere seems to have the same coloration of the 1960s and the anti-war movement. What do you think of the similarities in, between that struggle and the nuclear power movement?
I think they're very important similarities because, you know, first came the bomb, and the commercial nuclear power program is a direct outgrowth of the technology of the bomb program. So the two, the same government agencies control them, same corporations, they're technologically intertwined. And similarly, the anti-war movement is connected with the anti-nuke movement. They're both part of the same broad political thrust. It's the same mobilization for survival, if you will. It's the rising of the people demanding their rights to live in a safe world where there's peace and justice and appropriate technology.
You know, some of our viewers in Austin might think that this issue was settled with the referendum a couple of months ago. Why are you still back out here? Is the issue still a hot one for you?
Of course the issue isn't settled. Even if we'd have won the referendum, that would might have led to Austin selling its share in the South Texas Project, but that doesn't stop the South Texas Project. It doesn't stop the nuclear power program. Also, if you noticed, Andy Sampson from Brazoria County, who spoke earlier at the rally, has said that Houston Lighting and Power has told him that the cost of the STNP is $2.5 billion. Now, it's never been publicly announced in Austin that the cost is any more than $2 billion, and if his figures turn out to be correct, that means another $80 million cost overrun that has been withheld so far, on $80 million cost overrun on Austin's share of this plant that has not been told to the people in Austin yet. And so the city council will have to go back to the voters for more money, and this issue is nowhere near being settled in Austin. Nowhere near it.
Thanks, Rick.
But the decisions that are being made are very clearly intended to protect investment and to maintain the concentration of power in the hands of a few people. We know that the well-being of people is not important when we continue to produce radioactivity in order to generate electricity that we don't need. The American government, which often looks after corporate interests over those of the people, plays a large role in perpetuating the myth that we have to give up quality of life in the name of progress. We have to challenge this. We have to stop it. We are often, the government has people convinced that we are unpatriotic because we challenge the validity of saying that it's wrong to help the corporations and not the people. And we're also called emotional because we use words like survival and earth, but we can see the kind of decisions that have been made because the value of human emotion has not come into play. So this is what... this is what we're doing here today along with people all around the world. We're saying that it has to stop. It's frightening to consider the size and the strength of the inhumane system that we're challenging, but things are changing. All the people that are gathering this weekend did not do so a year ago. We're a member of a large and growing family that realizes that we have to act on our concern. We cannot afford to not act and hope our children survive to do so because they might not. We're living in the most critical time in the world's history, and we have to keep that in mind. If we believe in placing a value on life above all else, and if we believe that we can wield as much benign or benevolent power as we choose, then we have to believe we can win. Think of what one person, Karen Silkwood, did from speaking the truth, and think of what we all can do.
Because she had some secret big companies wanted to hide. Oh, well, they talk of nuclear safety and they talk of national pride. But we all know it's a death machine, and that's why Karen died. And it could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the things you were doing as if I were too. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and a writer of wrongs. It could have been me, but instead it was you. And it may be us, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if she can live for freedom, 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 freedom. If she can live for freedom, I can too. Sing this part with me. I can too. We can too.
But more terrible than anything was the god of the Phoenicians and the Ammonites, the god Moloch, who demanded the most terrible sacrifice of all. Moloch demanded the sacrifice of children who died by fire.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be children.